His independence 1 century ago was the product of the great courage and sacrifice of the Cuban people. That legacy has been debased by Mr. Castro, who has turned a beautiful island into a prison.
There was a time when the United States and Cuba were close partners, fighting against the Spanish Empire at the turn of the last century. But today it's an entirely different story. In the 48 years since Fidel Castro seized power in a revolution, the two countries have been hostile neighbors, separated by only a 90-mile stretch of water just south of the Florida Keys. Cuba has often played an outsized role in U.S. foreign policy, and it remains an emotional issue of the highest priority for nearly 1 million Cuban exiles now living in America. But with Fidel Castro's failing health, new questions arise about the future of the island and the prospects for U.S.-Cuba relations.
Dos hojas cortar.
We start with life on the island today and whether the winds of change may usher in a new reality in Cuba. The western Cuban province of Pinar del Río is known for its rich farmland, while the coastal region has seen an influx of high-end resorts catering to tourists from Europe and South America. But even as the country considers some economic reforms, it still holds fast to its socialist roots. This 38-year-old farmer works daily in the fields of this tobacco farm and coffee plantation. She's obligated to surrender 90% of her crop to the Cuban government. The remaining profit is hardly enough to support her family. Inside her small house, there's no running water or electricity.
It's difficult to get milk, and it gets bad quickly in the house. As for meat, we have chicken sometimes, and we eat pork once a year. There's nowhere to buy the food anyway. If there were a place to buy it, we would buy more.
You'll find signs of dilapidation everywhere on the island, even in Cuba's capital city. That point is not lost on a 33-year-old English teacher living in Havana.
I think that this country represents freeze. Freeze in time, in the development, in everything.
Like all Cubans in this story, we've withheld the teacher's name for his own protection. But he willingly talked about his life and how he supplements his meager salary of roughly $12 a month working as a tour guide. He lives in a modest apartment with his mother, his two daughters, and his common-law wife. Unable to afford a wedding ceremony, they never officially married. On a tour through his home, the teacher shows us his ration book, in which Cubans track their canasta familiar básica, a family basket of goods strictly regulated by the government. Monthly rations include 10 eggs, 1 pound of chicken, 5 pounds of sugar, 3 dozen bread rolls, and a bar of soap. It's barely enough to scrape by, so many citizens take matters into their own hands.
What happens is that there is a vast black market in Cuba, and you could be sitting in your apartment, and on a regular basis, you can pretty much predict the door is going to knock, and it's going to be the ham lady or the egg lady.
Julia Swag directs the Latin America program at the Council on Foreign Relations. She's traveled to Cuba nearly 30 times over the last 2 decades and says government employees often walk off with workplace supplies, from cooking oil to batteries, in order to make ends meet.
There's a totally perverse incentive system in Cuba where you work for maybe a paycheck of $20 or $30 a month, but then you steal the inputs of your labor and resell them on the black market to enhance what your paycheck itself doesn't deliver. And that is absolutely widespread.
And yet, many citizens have come to rely on certain benefits provided by the regime. Literacy rates on the island are at 97%, and key health indicators like life expectancy and infant mortality are on par with developed nations. Dagoberto Rodriguez is chief of the Cuban Interest Section in Washington, D.C., the office Cuba has instead of an embassy.
Free education and free healthcare services are the basic of the Cuban Revolution. It is a matter of pride for every Cuban to be able to send his or her children to any kind of school without paying a penny, to the hospital and get heart surgery without paying a cent.
But for the English teacher turned tour guide, the Cuban economic and political system is failing his countrymen.
I don't like at all the system.
I don't like at all this system because we have no development of the economy. It's completely dead. But like it or not, you have to support the system, for what are you going to do? It's fear.
Mark Falkoff agrees there's ample reason for Cubans to keep quiet. He's resident scholar emeritus at the American Enterprise Institute and author of Cuba, The Morning After, Confronting Castro's Legacy.
It is a police state, and one that dedicates a lot of attention to neighborhood spies, and it's a state that controls all economic resources, so people who get out of line lose their ration cards, their children can't go to school. It's a state with enormous resources to punish or sanction people who don't agree. And it's an island, so one has a sense of isolation.
That sense of isolation is felt by the Havana teacher, who has a sister living in Miami. He's long wrestled with the urge to join her.
Sometimes when I was thinking about leaving, but it was impossible. You can propose, you can say, okay, I have to do it, but then I take a risk for my life. I take a boat, I try to leave my country, but it's only when you have enough money saved. And if you don't have money, then you have to stay and wait and be patient.
Not all Cubans are so patient. Dennis Hayes is a former coordinator for Cuban affairs at the State Department.
You know, Castro, it's not by accident that he was able to survive as long as he did. I mean, he figured out that you don't have to kill or imprison all of your political opposition. You can export them. What he did is he exported the counter-revolution.
Over the last 48 years, over 1 million Cubans have fled north. But for many still on the island, Castro's defiance toward America clearly resonates. Mark Falkoff reminds us the U.S. had considerable political and military control over Cuba in the early half of the 20th century.
The United States was always the El Dorado, the prosperous, abundant country that they admired, liked, and wanted to emulate, and also the great imperialist power that was threatening Cuban sovereignty. From about 1901 on, if you study Cuban historiography, the two great villains are Spain and the United States. So the Cuban attitude towards the United States is a very complex one. It is the most highly developed version of the love-hate relationship.
There's no better evidence of this strained relationship than the U.S.-imposed economic embargo, in place since the Eisenhower administration. Over the years, it's been cited by Cuban officials as the main source of their country's economic woes. But Dennis Hayes says the embargo provides enormous political leverage to spark democratic reforms in Cuba.
Castro could have had the embargo lifted decades ago if he had chosen to have a basic respect for human rights, if he had been willing to allow the sorts of free expression that caught fire through all of Latin America in the 70s and 80s to take hold in Cuba. If he had allowed his economy to open up so that individuals could work hard and feed their families.
While Julia Swag agrees with Hayes' vision of a new political landscape in Cuba, she thinks the embargo is the wrong approach.
The central fallacy of U.S. policy toward Cuba today, under the Bush administration, but under the previous 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 years of American presidents, is that the United States will do something good for Cuba if Cuba first changes. The expectation today is, you, Raul Castro, if you commit political suicide, I, George Bush, will lift the embargo. This is an absolute non-starter. He's not somebody that is going to negotiate the end of the Cuban Revolution.
In Cuban folklore, Fidel is known as the heart and Raul the fist. Fidel's younger brother has been in power now for more than half a year, after commanding the Cuban military for decades. Raul Castro has made public overtures for negotiations between Cuba and the U.S., and some analysts see that as a sign the regime might change. But Dennis Hayes is skeptical.
Raul was always, in some ways, more pragmatic, but he was also much more ruthless. Fidel would say, we need to kill this guy. Raul would go and kill him. So, you know, we can't forget this. It would be a mistake, big mistake, to think that Raul is somehow more of a Democrat or more open to the prospect of human rights. What he is probably more open to, evidence is he's pragmatic in the sense of doing things to stave off economic collapse.
Julia Swag says Cuba's socialist system can only cover up the negative cash flow for so long.
The problem now for the future is that without the charisma of Fidel Castro, repression alone ain't going to do it. And with a highly educated population and a young demographic that want to see themselves as having a future, they don't necessarily see themselves as stakeholders in that project.
In the end, Mark Falkoff thinks there's little the U.S. can do right now to dismantle the Castro regime.
I don't think anything is going to happen right away. We are all waiting for Fidel Castro to die, because at that point, the issue will be revisited. I don't think it will be revisited until then. So we have to just settle back and be patient and wait for history and biology to take their course.
For America Abroad, I'm Ray Suarez. Coming up, the struggle between President Clinton and Congress over the Cuban embargo. And one of President Kennedy's top advisors looks back at the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Castro called in the Soviet ambassador saying that it was his conviction the Americans were going to invade and therefore Khrushchev should fire the missiles and wipe this scum from the face of the earth.
That's ahead on this edition of America Abroad. I'm Ray Suarez.
And I'm Steve Roberts.
And this is America Abroad.
The island of Cuba occupies a special place in history. It was precisely to these shores that Columbus sailed his ships 5 centuries ago. It was here that Europeans first set foot on American soil.
For 400 years after Christopher Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492, Cuba was a part of the Spanish Empire. But in the late 19th century, Cuban anti-colonialists looked to Americans for support in their fight for freedom, while at the same time worrying about American domination.
It's a very complex relationship, and we'll begin our story about this history in 1895, when Cuban guerrilla fighters battled Spanish troops for control of the island. Luis Perez, professor of history at the University of North Carolina, says the U.S. was paying close attention to this conflict, raging only 90 miles off its southern coast.
The nightmare of American statesmen from Adams and Jefferson, and perhaps even deep into the 20th century, is that a hostile European power would locate itself in Cuba and thereby threaten American strategic interest, maritime interest, commercial interest, economic interest, and pretensions to hegemony in the Western Hemisphere.
In 1898, the U.S. intervened in the conflict and, after defeating Spain, went on to occupy the island. For Cubans, the American occupation was a frustrating result of their war for independence. American legislators battled over what to do with the island. They feared that continued instability might lead to European intervention. Their solution was the Platt Amendment.
The American people, journalists, churches, civic associations were very sympathetic to the prospect of Cuban independence. But what the Platt Amendment effectively does is, on one hand, provides the appearance of an independent Cuba, but point by point, strips the republic of all essential attributes of sovereignty.
Over the next 30 years, the U.S. sent troops to Cuba 3 times to quell local insurrections and ensure stability on the island. The presence of American troops helped guarantee order, but caused the Cuban people to grow resentful of U.S. influence. Beginning in the 1930s, the U.S. took a new approach to Latin America and pursued a good neighbor policy. President Franklin Roosevelt.
The American Republic to the south of us have been ready always to cooperate with the United States on a basis of equality and mutual respect. But before we inaugurated the good neighbor policy, there was among them resentment and fear because certain administrations in Washington had slighted their national pride and their sovereign rights. And so we have abandoned the Platt Amendment that gave us the right to intervene in the internal affairs of the Republic of Cuba.
In many Latin American countries, the U.S. did indeed take a more hands-off approach. But Cuba was deemed too important to risk a policy of strict non-intervention. After another revolt broke out in 1933, the United States helped install Sergeant Fulgencio Batista, who would go on to dominate Cuban politics for much of the next 25 years.
For 6 years, the army has run the country and Batista has been virtual dictator. Here is one strong man who is well-loved, who has ruled wisely and preserved freedom.
Batista instituted some progressive reforms and brought stability to Cuba. Throughout his rule, the U.S. and Cuba developed a close political and cultural relationship. Luis Perez.
Cuba from the 20s through the end of the 1950s is an advanced representation of a people, of a culture, of a nation that falls in the thrall of American cultural forms. Tens of thousands of Cubans are educated in the United States. Hundreds of Cuban army officers are trained by the Department of Defense. And with that comes a Cuban affection for American culture.
Oh, would you like to spend the weekend in Havana? How would you like to see the Caribbean shore? Come on, run away over sand to where the view and the music is tropical.
It is not unusual where someone would go out in an anti-American demonstration in Havana, and after the demonstration ended, to go to a movie theater and watch and enjoy an American movie. And so the cultural penetration and the degree to which Cubans opened themselves up and gladly received American cultural forms is one of the most remarkable developments of the first half of the 20th century.
But America's relationship with Cuba had a darker side.
The arrival of organized crime, the presence of the mafia, gambling, prostitution, drugs, the country is slowly perceiving itself to becoming this very distasteful cesspool of the worst elements of American popular culture.
During the 1950s, Batista's rule became increasingly repressive, and despite economic advances, income inequality continued to plague Cuba. Growing resistance to Batista soon turned violent as guerrilla uprisings and urban riots broke out across the country. The leader of this guerrilla movement was Fidel Castro.
In front of the presidential palace in Havana, nearly a million people, which is just about the whole population of this capital city, gathered at the bidding of their new leader, Fidel Castro. The summary courts-martial and executions of Batista followers have brought criticisms from abroad, especially America. Castro wanted to know how his countrymen felt on the subject, and the hysterical reception shows that Cubans would support just about anything he did.
The Cuban people were fed up with the political violence and corruption that had beset Cuba for decades. Castro offered a new beginning and an end to American influence. Luis Perez.
The power of Fidel Castro lay in part in his capacity to summon a vision of dignity, of independence, and a large part of that was this unrelenting attack on the United States for the misdeeds of the previous 50, 60 years. So this becomes one of the central elements by which Fidel Castro mobilizes politically the Cuban people.
For American officials, the rise of an aggressive communist leader in Cuba revived the age-old fear of a hostile government just off America's shore. Castro fueled those fears by nationalizing American businesses, and in 1961, the U.S. broke off diplomatic relations. Soon after, the CIA devised a plan in which a group of Cuban dissidents, armed and trained by the intelligence agency, would attack the island at the Bay of Pigs and start an uprising to free Cuba from Castro's hold. A Soviet propaganda film tells the rest of the story.
On April 17th, mercenary gangs supported by the United States began an armed attack on our country. We replied with mobilization of the entire people, and we went to meet the invaders. The enemy was confused. He had thought that our defense would crumble under the very first attack. He did not expect all the Cuban people to rise against him.
The failed Bay of Pigs attack embarrassed the Kennedy administration and strengthened Fidel Castro's grip on Cuba. The Cuban people expected that the revolution would bring democracy. But Castro had other plans, as he discussed in a 1961 BBC interview.
You obviously have a great deal of support among the people of Cuba, Dr. Castro. Why, in that case, do you not hold elections on a democratic basis?
We ask it to the people. People said we don't want political now because we are working. And political was good only for robbers and for criminals. We are building the house. After build the house, we will find the house and we'll organize the house.
Castro's promise of freedom and democracy never materialized. Instead, the new Cuban leader looked to the Soviet Union as his model.
You are regarded in many quarters, Dr. Castro, as a communist. Do you regard yourself as a neutral in the Cold War, like India or Egypt? Or do you regard yourself as aligned with the communist powers?
Why are you thinking in war? I think that the best thing for peace is thinking in peace. I am with the peace.
But peace was not to be had. Soon, the U.S. imposed an economic embargo on the island. At the same time, the Soviet Union and Cuba were becoming increasingly friendly. And in October 1962, that relationship caused a global crisis. President Kennedy.
This government, as promised, has maintained the closest surveillance of the Soviet military buildup on the island of Cuba. Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island. The purpose of these bases can be none other than to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere.
After 13 tense days, the two superpowers stopped just short of nuclear war. For the Kennedy administration, the Cuban Missile Crisis was seen as evidence of just how dangerous a hostile Cuba could be. Over the next two decades, Cuba actively supported communist revolutions in Latin America and Africa. The Reagan administration took a tough stand against Cuban influence, and Secretary of State Alexander Haig warned Cuba about its support for rebel movements in El Salvador.
There are reports of even larger shipments yet underway. All of this is being very, very carefully watched. I think we have made it very clear from the outset that this is a problem emanating first and foremost from Cuba, and it is our intention to deal with this matter at its source.
But global change, more than U.S. pressure, would present the gravest threat to the Castro regime.
The collapse of the Soviet Union precipitates what is, beyond any reasonable doubt, a catastrophic economic condition in Cuba. Anybody who had been in Cuba in the 90s cannot help but have a presentiment of an apocalypse in Cuba. All of a sudden, this economy just came to a grinding halt, and in many ways, it goes back in time. Tractors are replaced by oxen, cars are replaced by bicycles. There is this strange quiet that descends on Cuba as factories closed down, buses ceased to operate.
In 1992, Congress passed the Cuban Democracy Act, using both carrots and sticks to squeeze Cuba economically, while also encouraging people-to-people contacts across the Florida Straits. President George H.W. Bush signed the bill in front of an enthusiastic Miami audience.
Our policies and principles rest on a single belief: for freedom to rise in Cuba, Fidel Castro must fall. And today, the legislation that I signed today reflects our determination that the Cuban government will not benefit from U.S. trade or aid until the Cuban people are free, and it reflects another belief. I'm not going to let others prop up Castro with aid or some sweetheart trade deal.
Cuba's economic woes forced Castro to undertake modest market reforms, boost foreign investment, and encourage tourism on the island. At the same time, Castro stoked the fires of Cuban nationalism by describing the economic hardship as part of Cuba's struggle against the United States. In the last decade, the hostile relationship between the two countries has continued to generate controversy. The case of a 6-year-old refugee illustrated that all too well in 1999.
Around 5 o'clock Saturday morning, federal agents took Ilian from the home where he's been staying for almost 5 months. Attorney General Janet Reno says, in her words, time had run out. But there was anger in Miami as word of the seizure of Ilian spread throughout the Little Havana neighborhood. Clouds of smoke filled the air as crowds burned tires in the streets. Police there report making at least 80 arrests.
More recently, attention is focused on what may be the last days of the revolutionary figure who has ruled Cuba for 48 years. As the health of Fidel Castro fails, U.S. leaders have made new overtures to the Cuban people. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice in August 2006.
It has long been the hope of the United States that a free, independent, and democratic Cuba would be more than just a close neighbor. It would be a close friend. This is our goal now more than ever. And throughout this time of change, all of you must know that you have no greater friend than the United States of America.
Cuba and America are intimately connected by geography, culture, and history. The United States has always viewed a stable and friendly Cuba as crucial to American security, and through the last century has taken forceful steps to control events on the island. For their part, Cubans have been attracted to American culture, values, and prosperity, but resent America's history of intrusions into Cuban affairs. This complex and ambivalent relationship existed long before Fidel Castro, and it will likely endure long after his death. I'm Steve Roberts for America Abroad.
I'm Ray Suarez. When we think of the history between America and Cuba, the most infamous moment was the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962, when the world stood on the edge of nuclear disaster.
The United States' answer to what Adlai Stevenson termed Soviet blackmail in Cuba was a quarantine of all offensive weapons being shipped from Russia to that island fortress. The U.S. threw up a steel fence, prepared to stop any vessel carrying materials of war.
We talked with Theodore Sorensen, speechwriter and top advisor for President Kennedy, and started by asking him about the most critical moment of that two-week standoff.
Saturday, October 27, 5 days after the president had gone on nationwide television and announced to the country and the world that Soviet nuclear missiles had been placed on the island of Cuba, that Saturday the news was all bad. First, the ships were coming back again toward the barricade of destroyers that formed the blockade, and this time those Soviet vessels were accompanied by submarines, an indication that they were going to shoot their way through. On that same Saturday, the 27th, our reconnaissance plane, a U-2 plane of the type that had first identified those missiles, was shot down. So there again, we were on the brink of disaster. Then a U.S. Air Force plane based, I believe, in Alaska, his navigation controls malfunctioned, and he flew over Siberia. What were the Soviets to think? Presumably, they thought it was the beginning of World War III. So we were sitting in the cabinet room as the so-called XCOM, Executive Committee of the National Security Council. Word of all this reached the XCOM, and there was a grimace around the table. JFK broke the silence by saying, if your listeners will excuse me, this is what he said. There's always one SOB who doesn't get the message.
What's the impression that you take away not only from the diplomatic encounters between the United States and Cuba, but your personal encounters with Fidel Castro?
Believe it or not, years after the missile crisis was over, Americans, Soviets, and Cubans who had participated in the crisis for their respective governments would meet. We had one such meeting in Boston, one such in Moscow, one in Cuba, and then another one in Cuba. And we learned there that on that same Saturday, the 27th, Castro called in the Soviet ambassador to Havana, saying that it was his conviction the Americans were going to invade and therefore Khrushchev should fire the missiles and wipe this scum, or whatever the word, he used, I think, a worse phrase than that, from the face of the earth. At that last reunion, Castro had the Americans to lunch. And at that lunch, everybody was jovial and making toasts, and I made a toast in which I first chided him for sending a message calling us the scum of the earth and saying that we should be wiped out. And then I continued to say in my toast, I'm grateful that you sent that message through the Soviet ambassador, because it so rattled Khrushchev, it so alarmed him that everything was getting out of hand, that it was that combination of events that caused him to withdraw the missiles the next day.
Mr. Sorensen, a pleasure to talk to you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Theodore Sorensen was a speechwriter and top advisor for President Kennedy. The Soviet Union supported Fidel Castro's regime for 3 decades after the Cuban Missile Crisis, supplying the island with nearly $6 billion in annual aid. When the Iron Curtain fell in 1991, it sparked a wave of democratic transition across the globe, but Cuba remained staunchly communist, even as Castro coped with the loss of Soviet finances. The Clinton administration considered easing the long-standing embargo and engaging Cuban society. But as Garrick Utley reports, a surprising series of events ultimately led President Clinton to approve some of the toughest American sanctions ever against the island.
In 1993, the new Clinton administration entered the White House with a belief that greater engagement with Cuban society might foster change on the island. Morton Halperin was special assistant to President Clinton.
The hope was that we could, on the one hand, go further towards freeing up exchanges between Cubans and Americans by allowing more travel, by allowing more visas for Cubans to come to the United States, and then to begin ending the economic embargo. But I don't think anybody thought we were going to get there quickly.
But events would soon overtake Clinton's step-by-step approach. In an effort to ease discontent on the island, Fidel Castro announced in 1994 that Cubans were free to leave. More than 50,000 did, and headed for the United States.
The Cubans were putting people on rest and encouraging them to leave, and that became politically untenable in Florida. So the only way we can bring these 50,000 in is if we negotiate a deal with the Cubans that from then on, when we pick up people at sea, we will send them back to Cuba, and they will agree that they're not going to let people leave.
The Clinton administration's agreement with Cuba was a dramatic change in U.S. immigration policy towards the island. In 1994, a new Republican Congress swept into power, and the new congressional leadership worried that the Clinton administration was softening on Cuba. Roger Noriega was a Republican staff member in the House International Relations Committee.
We thought that the Clinton administration was going to look for any opportunity to normalize relations. Our conclusion was that things weren't going to change with some sort of grand gesture by the United States, and that the economic opening there wasn't really empowering people or encouraging a political opening.
To further pressure the Castro regime, Republican leaders drafted a bill that would tighten the U.S. embargo. The legislation was known by the name of its two sponsors, Senator Jesse Helms and Congressman Dan Burton. One of the most contentious sections of the Helms-Burton Act allowed Cuban Americans who had lost property following the 1959 revolution to sue foreign companies that had bought the confiscated property from the Castro regime.
Joining us now from Capitol Hill to discuss the sanctions is U.S. Senator Jesse Helms of North Carolina, a co-author of the legislation and head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Canada and some of our other key allies are very upset about this legislation and believe that the U.S. is trying to dictate their policy. Is that the intent or the effect of this legislation?
No, we are trying to draw attention to the fact that Fidel Castro is a tyrant in our hemisphere. I got news for Canada. You can't do business with Castro.
You are willing to jeopardize, then, U.S. relations with Canada and Mexico and members of the European Union?
No, I'm not willing to jeopardize any relations. The question is, are they willing to jeopardize their relations with us? All we're saying is obey our law.
Richard Nuccio was a senior policy advisor for Cuba at the State Department and later became the president's special advisor on Cuban affairs.
My strategy was to work with Senator Dodd's office to filibuster every attempt by Senator Helms to produce a vote on the Helms-Burton bill. And at that point, the Democrats were in the minority in the Senate, but we were still able to muster enough votes to keep the bill from being brought to the floor and being debated and voted on the floor.
But President Clinton was concerned that public opposition to Helms-Burton would cost him support among the Cuban exile community. Richard Nuccio remembers a frustrating exchange with Deputy National Security Advisor Sandy Berger.
You know, a logical question for any of the people I was going to on the Hill to try to enlist in a battle against Helms-Burton was, what is the president's position on this? And when I would go back to Sandy Berger and say, Sandy, what is the president's position on Helms-Burton? He would say, that's a good question. I'll have to get back to you on that. And the answer I got was, well, Rick, if the bill never gets to the president's desk for him to sign, we won't have to know what the president's view on the bill is, will we?
Despite Clinton's hesitance, the Helms-Burton bill stalled in the Republican-controlled Congress. By early 1996, it appeared the bill was doomed. Roger Noriega.
The only people that would tell you that it wasn't dead is probably me. And, you know, I don't know whether I talked much to my mother about it, but for all intents and purposes, it was not going to move anywhere in the Senate. They couldn't do it.
But later that month, everything changed.
It was the 1800 mission for Brothers to the Rescue, a group that helps refugees fleeing Cuba. Just after 1 o'clock yesterday, three planes belonging to Brothers to the Rescue leave Miami. They are warned by Cuba to stay away. Minutes later, MiG fighters leave Cuba. At 3:22, one of the Brothers to the Rescue planes flies 2 miles into Cuban airspace. Cuban fighter pilots ignore that plane and 2 minutes later shoot down one in international waters. Soon after, a Cuban fighter pilot shoots down another plane, this one 14 miles outside Cuban airspace.
Soon after the Brothers to the Rescue incident, President Clinton convened a national security meeting to consider military options, including a blockade or retaliatory airstrikes.
I believe it was the Joint Chiefs Chairman Shali Kashvili pointed out that it was the military's perspective that any of the military options would lead to a kind of back-and-forth escalation between the United States and Cuba that could lead eventually to an attack on Guantanamo and all-out war between the United States and Cuba. So, frankly, that was a very sobering discussion, I think, for everyone in the room.
President Clinton responded to the shoot-down by announcing that he would work to reach an agreement with Congress on the Helms-Burton legislation. It was a dramatic shift in the Clinton administration's approach. The shoot-down not only saved the bill, it put Congress in a position to push for even tougher legislation. The result was the addition of a clause that enshrined the embargo on Cuba into U.S. law for the first time in 37 years and made lifting of the embargo the prerogative of Congress rather than the president. It was a bitter pill for President Clinton to swallow, but he believed he had little choice. The president spoke at the signing of the Helms-Burton bill.
2.5 weeks ago, the world received a harsh reminder of why a democratic Cuba is so important in broad daylight and without justification. Cuban military jets shot down 2 unarmed United States civilian aircraft, causing the deaths of 3 American citizens and 1 U.S. resident. I ordered that my representatives work closely with Congress to reach prompt agreement on the Cuban Liberty and Democracy Solidarity Act. Today I sign it with the certainty that it will send a powerful, unified message from the United States to Havana that the yearning of the Cuban people for freedom must not be denied.
Morton Halperin believes the decision to sign the Helms-Burton Act was a mistake.
I think they just sort of panicked and decided, okay, they shut down an airplane, we have to be tough with them, there's the bill, we have to take whatever Congress wants.
Congress got what it wanted, but the bill never delivered the intended financial blow to the Castro regime. Roger Noriega blames Venezuelan leader Hugo Chavez and his oil subsidies.
We didn't see Chavez coming. And the reality is Chavez is the new Soviet banker for the regime. And so maybe we frightened off some Mexicans and Spanish and Europeans and Canadians from investing. But the regime has found ways around the direct impact of Helms-Burton.
But Roger Noriega does believe the bill made an important contribution to U.S. policy towards Cuba.
The very important part of the legislation was the codification of the embargo and sort of boxing the Clinton administration in on that. The really most effective argument about maintaining the embargo is why make a unilateral concession to a government on its last legs in a way that might resuscitate or buy at least 1 or 2, 3 or 4 more days of power for the guy who is the biggest obstacle to economic and political change in Cuba.
In its first 3 years, the Clinton administration attempted to gradually relax U.S. policy towards Cuba. But Castro's willingness to shoot down the Brothers to the Rescue planes put an end to this Clinton policy and reaffirmed the views of those who believed pressure was the best way to bring change to Cuba. Now that the strict American sanctions on Cuba are embedded in U.S. law, it'll take either new action in Congress or a new leadership in Cuba before relations between the two countries can improve. I'm Garrick Utley. for America Abroad.
Coming up, just how much influence does the Cuban-American exile community have on U.S. policy toward the island?
I've always seen U.S. policy towards Cuba as being more domestic than foreign. It has been a policy particularly to satisfy or win the votes of the Cuban-American community.
Don't blame the Cuban-Americans for America's concern. How could the United States not have a strong position?
That's ahead on this edition of America Abroad. I'm Ray Suarez, and this is America Abroad. Over the last half century, the U.S. has tried repeatedly to knock Fidel Castro from his perch as Cuba's leader. Some of those early attempts focused on taking Castro out, quite literally, as in assassination. The alleged CIA schemes included an exploding cigar, poisoned coffee, and a ballpoint pen rigged with a deadly hypodermic needle. Knowing of Castro's love for scuba diving, the intelligence agency dreamed up a wetsuit lined with toxins, and even a bomb disguised as a brightly colored seashell. Castro once said, "If surviving assassination attempts were an Olympic event, I'd win the gold medal." Those failed assassination plots are now a strange footnote to history, but it's no secret the U.S. remains committed to ousting the Castro regime. For their part, Cuban Americans still dream of democracy on the island, and over the years, they've passionately supported the strong U.S. policy against Cuba. But as Ron Nessen reports, the Cuban-American community is no longer of one mind on how to approach Cuba, with or without Fidel Castro.
A second night of celebration in Miami's Little Havana after word that Fidel Castro handed over power while undergoing intestinal surgery. The Cuban government's claim that Castro is in good spirits barely dented hopes that Cuba's dictator is finally about to go.
After Fidel Castro's 1959 socialist revolution, relations between the United States and Cuba went quickly from friendly to outright hostile. For decades, the vast majority of Cuban Americans supported tough American sanctions against Cuba as the best hope for promoting democratic change in their homeland. On the streets of Miami, you'll find countless anti-Castro billboards overhead, and you'll hear that same message coming from radios of cars that pass by.
La voz del cubano libre, un programa dirigido directamente a nuestra patria.
WQBA, pronounced Cuba in Spanish, is harshly critical of the Castro regime and what it has done to Cuba. Mixing discussion about what might have been, like the 1961 Bay of Pigs invasion, with a here-and-now debate over how to deal with Cuba when Castro dies. Another station, Radio Mambí, is named for the Cubans who fought for freedom against the Spanish Empire in the late 19th century. Today, the term is synonymous with Cuban exiles who oppose the Castro regime. One of the marquee programs is a talk show hosted by Alina Fernandez, one of Castro's daughters, who split with her father in the early 1990s and left the country. These stations speak to and for the Cuban-American community in Florida, which has made its voice heard in election after election on behalf of candidates who support a tough approach toward Cuba. The University of Miami's Andy Gomez is a senior fellow at the university's Institute for Cuban and Cuban American Studies. His parents fled Cuba shortly after Castro came to power.
So I've always seen U.S. policy towards Cuba as being more domestic than foreign. Domestic in the essence that whether Republicans or Democrats have been in the White House in the last 50 years, it has been a policy particularly to satisfy or win the votes of the Cuban-American community, particularly in South Florida.
While a majority of Cuban exiles still back the embargo against Cuba, polls show that support has declined in recent years. Gomez says that reflects a generational change within the Cuban-American community.
This is not as homogeneous of a community as it was 10 years ago. I think the Elian Gonzalez issue a couple of years ago began, I say that it could have been the turning point, the maturation point, as to we as a community begin to think and question the existing policies.
Frank Calzone, executive director of the Center for a Free Cuba in Washington, says America's opposition to the Cuban regime results from the company that Castro keeps.
How could the United States not have a strong position in regard to Cuba when the Castro government has strung a lie of Mr. Chavez, of the regime in Iran, the North Koreans? So don't blame the Cuban Americans for America's concern. I think it has a lot to do with the hostility of those regimes to America, and a little bit having to do with the role that Cuban Americans play in America's foreign policy discussion.
Calzone points out that some of Castro's biggest opponents in Congress have come from districts with very few Cuban Americans, including strong anti-communists like Dan Burton of Indiana and Jesse Helms of North Carolina, the Republican architects of the 1996 law which tightened the embargo. But today, the new democratically controlled Congress has several bills in the works designed to loosen the sanctions against Cuba. California Democrat Hilda Solis is not Cuban-American, but she's part of the House Cuba Working Group, a bipartisan committee pushing for greater engagement with the Castro regime.
There's more support on the part of the Republican Party, members of Congress and in the Senate, who agree with opening up that trade and that dialogue. And I think that even members of the Miami community who have been staunch anti-Fidel communities are now taking a different look very closely at wanting to be a part of the debate with respect to allowing for their families to be able to travel and see their loved ones in Cuba. So I think little by little attitudes are changing. I'm not saying it's all complete. No, it's going to take time. It's going to take education. But I think the willingness is there.
Frank Calzone thinks it's not Cuban-American attitudes that will ultimately affect a change in U.S. policy.
The Cuban government would like to say that U.S. policy is a result of the Cuban-American influence. I would argue that the minute that the Castro government is no longer a threat to the United States, that day American national interests will be looked at by anyone in the White House and said, this is a time to have a better relationship with the Castro brothers, but not until then.
Many Cuban-Americans have long believed the death of Fidel Castro would spell the end of a tyrannical regime. But now it appears that communism may outlast Castro, and the exile community is beginning to question whether changes in U.S. policy are needed. It remains to be seen whether Cuban-American attitudes will shift dramatically or how that change will affect America's approach to the island. I'm Ron Nesson for America Abroad.
You never see me homesick, 'cause from home I'm never away. Wherever I am, I'm home, in Cuba or the USA.
I'm Ray Suarez. The reports this hour got me thinking more deeply about how intertwined America has been with its neighbor, Cuba. I've spoken to Cubans on the streets of Havana who've told me of their deep love of their country, their admiration for many of the gains of the revolution, and of their affection for the United States, and the fascination they have with the news they get from relatives there. The poet and freedom fighter José Martí is revered on both sides of the Straits of Florida. His poetry is chiseled into walls in a Miami plaza where old men play dominoes and smoke cigars, and in Havana, where his iconic mustachioed portrait looks down on busy streets right alongside Che and Marx. Both sides say they are Martí's true heirs. I have in my library a lovely old book filled with American jingoist fervor and Cuban nationalist fire called War in Cuba. Its stories relate how, in the late 19th century, the outgunned, brave, and plucky Cuban revolutionaries threw off the yoke of Spanish imperial domination, supported by Teddy Roosevelt and his band of American Rough Riders, of course. But only 110 years, the blink of an eye in historical terms, has transformed the world in that book beyond all recognition and moved Cuba to a very different place in the American imagination. The Soviet missiles are long gone, and now so's the Soviet Union. But the hostility between Havana and Washington remains, a relic of the Cold War both sides find difficult to abandon. Nearly five decades of animosity makes the once intimate relationship between the U.S. and Cuba seem a distant memory. How and if that memory will be revived as Fidel fades are questions that will, for the time, remain unanswered. And that concludes this edition of America Abroad, After Castro, America and Cuba. For transcripts and more, visit us on the web at americaabroadmedia.org. Our executive producer is Aaron Lobel. Our senior producer is John Haas. Our director of broadcasting and station relations is Steve Martin. The production team includes Chris Williams, Alana Weinberg, Kim Reyes, and Phoebe Park, with help from Patricia Guadalupe. And thanks to Frank Mora, Richard Feinberg, and Feature Story News. Archival audio comes from the Vanderbilt University Television News Archives, the BBC, British Movie Talk, CNN, CBS, NBC, and ABC, British Pathé, the Roosevelt, Kennedy, Carter, Clinton, and Bush Presidential Libraries, the Edinburgh University Data Library, and the White House. I'm Ray Suarez. Join me for another edition of America Abroad.
Support for this program comes from the Ford Foundation, the Draper Richards Foundation, the Star Foundation, the Hewlett Foundation, and Foreign Affairs Magazine, on the web at foreignaffairs.org, home of updates and briefings by Foreign Affairs authors, and from The American Interest, a magazine devoted to illuminating America's global role. Support also comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide, and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Champaign-Urbana area weather for today, mostly cloudy, a 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms, the high in the low 80s. Mostly cloudy tonight, the low in the low 60s. Tomorrow, partly sunny, the high in the upper 80s. Mostly cloudy tomorrow night, the low in the low 60s. And for Wednesday, a 40% chance of showers and thunderstorms, partly sunny, the high in the mid 80s. This is AM 580, WILL Urbana.